I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com and the Big Change Program with Josh Lajani. This podcast is part of my mission to help you live a vivid and voluptuous life. Two quick things before we get to today's interview, which is amazing. You're going to love it. First, I want to remind you that you can download the Stop Self-Sabotage Report at plantyourself.com/sabotage, all lowercase, S-A-B-O-T-A-G-E. I got some feedback that I'd like to share with you from someone who emailed me and said, I loved this. I loved how you began the report with your car story. There is just so much information to unpack and reread. I feel very fortunate that you are so freely sharing your wealth of knowledge and excellent teaching skills with us. I haven't gotten back to that person with permission to use their name, but I feel okay just grabbing those couple of sentences, because that's exactly what I was hoping people would say when they downloaded and read the Sabotage Report. Again, you can get yours at plantyourself.com/sabotage. And the second thing is, I am so grateful to all the people who became patrons this past week. You'll hear their names at the end if you listen all the way through. And the one thing that concerns me is I spent about 4 minutes at the beginning of last week's podcast talking about money and talking about patronage and how you can support it. And I don't like that when other people do that on their podcast all the time, and I don't want to do it on my podcast all the time either. So I want to keep this real short, but tell you that the money really, really helps. It's helping me just looking at those numbers starting to increase to attain a monthly figure that feels like I could sustain this thing over time without having to sacrifice my family's needs or sacrifice the lifestyle that I want. And if you just want to help out, just go to plantyourself.com. and click the Patreon button on the right, and everyone who subscribes gets access to the 3 times a month Healthy Habit Huddles that so far have only been for members of the Tribe of Well and for my coaching clients and my students. That's all I want to say about that, because I said I don't want to turn this into a lengthy advertisement that turns people off. So let's get right to today's interview. My guest is Dr. Kim Williams, recent past president of the American College of Cardiology and a vegan and a recommender of vegan diets for his patients and for the world of humans. And when I invited Dr. Williams to be a guest on the podcast, that's kind of the limit of what I knew about him. Just a real big deal in not just the plant-based world, but in the world, in the medical world at large, and a guy who is promoting a plant-based diet. But once I started researching and once we started having our conversation, that was just the tip of the iceberg of this remarkable, remarkable man. The things he's overcome, the motivation he's brought with him, and the breadth of spirit and knowledge and passion and persistence is just one of the most inspiring conversations I've ever had. So without further ado, Dr. Kim Williams, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Howard.
You are kind of a big deal in the plant-based world and in the wider world of cardiology. I would love for you just to start by telling us how you got into medicine. What was it that first piqued your interest and was able to sustain you through all the grueling years?
It really was a compilation of things that I was sort of doing a lot of reflecting the older I get and what made me go into medicine. I think the first foray was being a five-year-old and having my stepdad die of an intracranial hemorrhage. And I actually learned what that term meant as a five-year-old, hypertension, what that meant. And so I was always interested in cardiovascular phenomena. So the biggest problem of him passing away was not having a stepdad, but the other part was that we were relatively impoverished, and so that sort of didn't stimulate me to go into any particular field, but it did mean that I didn't have the things I always needed. One of them was a winter coat one year. When I was 11, I ended up with a pneumonia in the hospital. That was a real moment for me because I just got an up close look at healthcare on the south side of Chicago, and you know, given it was 1965, but still, the way I knew that the medications were supposed to come at a certain time and they weren't, and you know, so I actually decided then that I was going to be a physician on the south side of Chicago and I was going to try to improve quality. Interestingly enough, the first episode was probably more important than the second. I didn't end up going into infectious disease or pediatrics. I ended up in cardiovascular with a very special interest in hypertension. Proud to say that our American College of Cardiology guidelines will be coming out hopefully in the next 10 weeks, not the next 10 months. It's in review right now. And it'll have a lot to say about the management of hypertension, and hopefully we will have an impact on how that is managed from medications to lifestyle. But as it turns out, that interest in hypertension sort of would drive me to either cardiology or nephrology, and I was intensely interested in both. But you know, you end up having to go with, you know, the kind of work that you feel like you could do, no matter how tired you were. And that was cardiology. I just love the field. So that's really how I got there. And I was very happy for the majority of my career to be on the south side of Chicago. I'm now on the west side. I was at University of Chicago for almost 30 years and left because of issues in terms of patient advocacy. They were coming up with policies that were going to make it difficult to take care of the people from my neighborhood. So I had to find places where I could do that, and I did that for a while in Detroit, taking care of inner-city patients, a lot of hypertension, a lot of coronary artery disease, a lot of stroke, a lot of kidney failure. And you feel when you're doing that work that you're not just serving the community, but you're serving the entire country. What a lot of people don't know is that the ravages of systemic hypertension are the debilitation that happens with a stroke. Most people would actually prefer death to a stroke and disability that impacts their family, their finances, their ability to work, everything. But then you got the whole kidney failure thing, which is really almost pre-programmed in African Americans. By a lot of times it's genetic, with the APOL1 gene making you much more likely to develop kidney failure if you have the diabetes, hypertension, the risk factors. And it turns out that once you're on dialysis, you know, everyone used to say, that's kind of a death sentence, you'll be dead in 5 years. Not true in African Americans. They tolerate dialysis for long periods of time, 15, 20 years. And the interesting thing is that $86,571 per dialysis patient that's paid by Medicare, because you automatically qualify for Medicare if you're on dialysis.
Wait, what's the number again?
$86,571. Now, that was 3 years ago, the last time I looked. It's probably...
And that's, is that for like an average for all time or per year?
That is per year, per dialysis beneficiary. Really. So just think of what good we could do if we managed hypertension better, if we eliminated or at least decreased the number of particularly African-American patients who were going into kidney failure and going on dialysis. What a patriotic thing that would be. We'd have more money for inner city education. We'd have more money for building roads and bridges, for goodness sakes. So anyway, why focus on that as a plant-based nutrition in-minded cardiologist? Is because the majority of hypertension could be eliminated if people would just pay attention to diets that have been shown to reduce or eliminate hypertension, and that's pretty much plant-based diet. DASH stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, has good data. You know, it's not completely plant-based, but they do have randomized trials. And those randomized trials show substantial improvement, decrease in the number of medications, better blood pressure control. But there's a lot of data out there that indicates that if a person does completely plant-based nutrition, particularly with a lot of grains and a lot of vegetable protein, that they could dramatically improve their blood pressure. And people fall into about one of three groups. And in my practice, it's about one-third, one-third, one-third. Mild improvement, moderate improvement, and complete elimination of the disease. No more medications for high blood pressure. Now, those people are usually the ones who do the diet, do the exercise on a regular basis, and lose the weight, particular central weight. If you do those three things, gosh, we're talking about a disease that doesn't have to exist.
So there's so much that you just said in there that I'd like to unpack, but I want to kind of go back to the very beginning, because it's really interesting that you experienced, so you know, the loss of a stepfather to a serious medical condition, subsequent impoverishment, dealing with a medical system that wasn't serving your family, and your response was like really sort of practical and like unemotional, almost like there's so many other ways that you could have responded to that set of situations, from, you know, like becoming a radical, becoming a community organizer like Barack Obama in Chicago. Like what were you thinking when you said, well, you know, there's all these problems and I'm going to enter the system and just practically contribute, roll up my sleeves and contribute, as opposed to, like, I could imagine myself in those circumstances just wanting to tear things down.
That's interesting. I think you're right. I have to admit that I wasn't much of a student back in grammar school. It was that episode that made me a little more focused on academics, and you know, took another year or so. But once I grew up a little bit and realized that there was a relationship between my ability to help people. It wasn't just me, I have to admit. It wasn't just me in that hospital. Those were wars with, you know, I think that mine was relatively semi-private. I think there were four kids in the room. And I just felt bad for every one of those kids. I was probably the oldest and the least sick. And, you know, it's kind of like you really want to do something. And so I think most people, given the situation where they're seeing people who are suffering, they would want to reach out and help. And to the extent that medicine is science and the language of science is math, and I had any talent in science and math, then it's kind of like my responsibility to go in there and do something. But I hear what you're saying. Not everybody would be motivated that well. It probably depends on what their own skills are. If they were a person of words, they would probably want to write a newspaper article about it. I mean, and so I know what you mean, but I think for me, math and science were the ways of which I could communicate with the world.
Wow. And were you like clear at that point, like age 11, like, okay, I want to go into medicine?
Yeah, I mean, it really, that was the one, that one experience that solidified it. You know, like I said, it might have taken another year and a half or so before I actually got the pieces, because, you know, that's one of the problems that we face right now. I'm digressing, but only a little bit, that we still have a crisis in terms of workforce. We don't have enough women in cardiology yet. We don't have enough underrepresented minorities. And part of the issue with underrepresented minorities, particularly African-American men, is that they don't have a mentor who could say, you know, if I could have just, you know, had a mentor who I could say, okay, I decided I want to go into medicine. What should I do? And it probably wouldn't have taken me a year and a half to figure out that I probably need to get good grades so I can get into college, go to medical school. That you know, took a little while.
Did you meet doctors who kind of looked like you and from your neighborhood?
And that's really my point. I did not. There were some. I just didn't see them. They didn't live in my neighborhood because I was in my neighborhoods. We were poor enough that we moved every year. So we used to laugh at the fact that I went to 8 different grammar schools. Now, if you add that to the fact that I taught tennis for the Chicago Park District, I know every neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. And so it's actually an advantage now, but it didn't seem so much back then.
Mm. Did you get encouragement from, teachers, from your mom, from other family members or community people? Like, yeah, this is a path that we think you can succeed on? Because if there weren't other trailblazers?
No, I think, most of the family thought that I would follow my grandfather into the ministry, be a Southern Baptist preacher. And in my high school, there were a couple of teachers who were encouraging. My own particular advisor said, I don't know how you can do this. It's very difficult from inner city schools. And he didn't say it in exactly those words, but he was saying that don't apply to the University of Chicago. You'll never get in. I just ignored him and applied anyway and did get in. And that you're pointing out a real deficit in some places that the guidance counselors and the lack of real good role models. So we're actually approaching that. We're talking about having more of the underrepresented minority physicians do as much giving back to the community and going and letting people know that, yeah, they too can do this. It's interesting that having role models really does work. And this is my own personal theory, but I was talking about women in cardiology being underrepresented. Almost half of our internal medicine residents are women, but only about 20% of our cardiology fellows are women. And part of it is lifestyle, part of it's role modeling. But they can't say, oh, cardiologists are just too busy, and so, young women want to have a family. They can't do that and be a cardiologist. First of all, that's not true. You certainly can. But when you look at general surgery, which is really very demanding, the call schedule is very demanding, that's a 50-50 now, and it's a big change. And my own personal theory is that it's Grey's Anatomy. Is this season 12 or season 13 or something like that? And these young women who are applying to general surgery have grown up having role models on television of African-American, Hispanic, and Caucasian women who are all living their lives as surgeons and having a great time. I think if we need more of that, and we need more buy-in. I have to say that American College of Cardiology is working on this. We have a task force specifically to try to improve these disparities in who does cardiology. And also the American Medical Association has a specific program called Doctors Back to School, where doctors will go to the communities, go into the schools, and talk with physician-minded kids and those who are not. What I'd like to see happen is a lot more, I'd say infiltration would be a good word, of our historically black colleges and universities. It was pointed out to me by one of the students at one of them at Hampton Institute that, nobody comes by and talks about this kind of thing, but there are people who have already gotten to the college and probably do have some capabilities in math and science. Let's just give them some direction. So we're just going to keep after it, because we know that if we can get more African-American and Hispanic, particularly, physicians, that'll improve our healthcare system.
That's so interesting about Grey's Anatomy having that effect, because one of my favorite books is called The Talent Code.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know it, but it's sort of like looking at hotbeds of talent. And he talks about like one Dominican baseball player made it to the major leagues and became a star, and then 10 years after that, like, there was an explosion of Dominican talent. And a similar thing, I think, with Anna Kournikova in Russia, and then 10 years after she won a title, like, this Russian Girls Academy, like, dominated tennis for a while.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other great, and since you mentioned tennis, the other great one is actually the Czech Republic. It started off with Martina. She defected. She's American now. But then it was Helena Suková. And all of a sudden, young girls who were in the Czech Republic, as it changed from they were all born, this generation was born in the Czechoslovakia, but became the Czech Republic. They all saw that this is a way they could just literally work their behind off, just work so hard that they can get out of poverty and have something for their families. And so, you know, if you're playing Fed Cup, you know, Federation Cup, you know, and it's United States against Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic, you know, they could come in with their C team, and they have so many wonderful players. So you're absolutely right. You get just a couple of people who say that this can be done. This is a pathway to success, and it can infect an entire group.
Mm. So at the same time as you're pursuing a career that was not traditionally available to African Americans, especially from an inner city, you were also pursuing a sport that, like, I think Arthur Ashe was like on the Davis Cup team for the first time in 63 when you would have been like 8 years old.
Right.
Like you chose tennis. I find that really interesting as well. Like you're like a double trailblazer.
Well, that really was a lot of interesting happenstance that formed my career in several ways. You know, it's funny to talk about stuff that happened a long time ago, but yeah, if it gives hope to anybody that to hear a funny, crazy story. So I was actually a chess player, and I was one of the best chess players in the state, and Calumet High School on the south side of Chicago, which had not been known for quality chess. That, you know, it was usually something reserved for the bigger schools, usually, you know, Caucasian schools, not the inner city schools. And it turns out that we worked our way up to pretty much the top of the ladder in the Chicago public school system and qualified for state, and we were doing really well. And one day, my whole chess team said that Calumet High School is starting a tennis team, and they were all going to go out. So I just went out to be with the guys when the chess season was over. It had nothing to do with really wanting to be a tennis player. But again, like that cardiology thing, the coach gave me a couple of things. Here's how you hit a backhand. Here's how you hit a forehand. I worked on it on my own, came back, and next thing you know, I was playing number three singles, having never even played the sport before. Okay, so then it got interesting. The University of Chicago actually has had a long-running program called, believe it or not, The Program, where they seek out African-American kids and try to help them both academically and athletically. They draw them in with the athletics, and they put on a sports program, and you do sports in the morning, and then in the afternoon you work on whatever academic issues you've had, math, science, absolutely the broad range of, and this is totally supported a little bit by NCAA, a little bit by a few charities, but most of the bill is borne by the University of Chicago, and it's certainly their facilities. So if you ever go on campus in the summer, you see the kids in the maroon t-shirts, those who look African-American in their city, that is the program. Well, it turns out that one of the kids that we played from another inner city school told us as a team about the program, and I actually didn't have a plan other than playing chess that summer, and so I actually went over there to see if I could learn some tennis, and there I was on the court with 60 other inner city kids, and the guy who was giving this, you know, fantastically large group lesson, turns out he was a minority recruiter for the admissions department for University of Chicago, and he was the varsity tennis coach. Unbelievable. He only taught it that 1 year, and I talked to him after the first day about my wanting to go to the University of Chicago, but I'd been told I wouldn't get in and all this stuff, and he actually, unbeknownst to me, set up an interview. I just thought, he just told me to go to this building and talk to this guy. I didn't realize that was my college interview. There I was in my tennis clothes. And it turns out that I actually did get in the University of Chicago, and he did become my tennis coach. He actually, he was still such a great player at an older age, we actually played pro events together as doubles partners after I grew up in the sport. I think the next part of it that makes it sort of improbable is that I really was kind of poor and didn't have a lot of resources. And didn't have a lot of help. And getting good at tennis meant that I could teach lessons. And once I was teaching lessons, I could pay my tuition. And everybody's talking about how they came out of school with a lot of debt. I was almost debt free, and it's mostly because of tennis. So I owe tennis my medical career and pretty much. And so it's been a lot to the University of Chicago in that program.
So do you have like ninja time management skills like my friends who are doctors? I remember when they were going through med school and like they barely had time to brush their teeth.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you should say that, because I still, this is not a live interview, so I can't strip for you. I always wear tennis clothes under my clothes. tennis might break out, but more importantly, I'm just used to doing it. I used to go from the wards, if there was a break for an hour and a half, schedule a tennis lesson, go to usually Lake Meadows Tennis Club in Chicago, teach the lesson, speed on back, finish work, doing studying. And I kept interdigitating tennis and medicine like that for a very long time. And they did unfortunately become sort of at crossroads or at loggerheads in the summer of 1976, when I was in a qualifier for the U.S. Open. I was beating the number one seed, and I knew that if I won that tournament, I was going to go to the U.S. Open, and I was going to have to miss part of medical school, which meant if you miss a week, you're done for the quarter. If you miss the quarter, you're done for the year. The really good thing is that up a set and a break in the second set, I hurt my back. I finished the match, but I really couldn't play, and the guy was a pretty brainy guy. He figured out that I couldn't move to my left, and he hit one to my right and then move it to the left. And next thing you know, the match was over, and I was on my way back to Chicago and went back to medical school and never looked back. And, you know, I often think about that. You know, I never had another back injury. And I said, you know, would I have really given up 1 year of interacting with patients, teaching students, influencing medical care, you know, so that I could have played professional tennis? And I think the answer is no, pretty resoundingly. So I'm pretty glad that I had that that little tweak that took me 6 weeks to get over, and you know, I was back playing and no problem. And but any thought of not going back to medical school and delaying it for tennis, which is what my coach was telling me I had to do, you got to do it, you got to try, all that went away.
Yeah, it's like your some inner wisdom said, let's tweak the back, because we know this is the preferred path.
I think so.
Wow, fascinating. So you you went to medical school. You decided on cardiology, and I guess I'm guessing for a certain number of years you were what we'll call a traditional cardiologist.
Mm-hmm. Traditional in the way of my
special, like not a crazy plant-based guy. I mean,
exactly. I was interested in diet for a long time. My mom had, even though we were fairly poor, she thought that the way to get out of being poor was to go to school. So when I was in college, she was in grad school. So it must have been sometime when I was probably eighth grade or ninth grade, she was in a junior college, and someone told her about the Ansel Keys stuff, that cholesterol caused heart disease. And so she had actually, and that red meat caused colon cancer. That was the late 60s. I mean, this data has been out there for a long time. All of that was turned out to be true. And so she had tried to make us vegetarians, and I went along with it. I was vegetarian until I was married in 81, and the marital negotiation changed it to pesco vegetarian with some chicken, not knowing, because most physicians do not get any counseling on nutrition, not knowing that that was a low-fat diet. It was not a low-cholesterol diet. And therefore, it was not healthy for someone who had the genes to develop high cholesterol, which I found out that I had. Now, whatever that, as it turns out, as time went on, I got older. I had an LDL cholesterol, the dangerous stuff, the bad cholesterol. That had gotten up to 170 back in the time where 110 would have been considered good. And above 160 meant you need to be on a statin drug. Before starting the drug, I just started fasting and that day and repeated it. It was still the same. But then I happened to see a publication by David Jenkins on vegan diet. And this was happening at a time when I had been primed to be interested in diet because a patient in my lab had had a marked improvement in her scan on the Ornish diet. So I was thinking of this diet stuff anyway, and I saw the Journal of American Medical Association published David Jenkins' study on, you know, plant sterols, almonds, soluble fiber, and vegetable protein as a way to lower cholesterol, and it did it very successfully, did it equal to a statin. So instead of grabbing a pill, I grabbed the diet, and 6 weeks later, my cholesterol was really normal and it almost fallen in half. And so I've been with it ever since and started, again, following the data, you know, feeling like I really should have known that. I really should have been counseling my patients the whole time. You know, it's not just about colon cancer. It's not just about, you know, obesity. This is your cholesterol is going to plug up your arteries. It's been the leading cause of death in the United States since 1918, continues to be. It's actually growing again after 44 decades of decline. It's now growing again in terms of cause of mortality.
And we when you say that you're talking about cardiovascular disease?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not sure everybody heard that, but the CDC, if they Google it, they'll see it. The CDC came out with the latest numbers for 2014. It's emblazoned in my brain. I'm sorry. It was 214.1 patients per 100,000 dying of cardiovascular disease. Still is number one. And in 2015, that went up to 218.5. And that what was so remarkable about it is that's the first time in 40 years that there had been an increase in cardiovascular death in the United States.
Number is what is age adjusted per 100,000?
Yeah, indeed. And you know, and so why is it? Why is it? CDC is blaming it on diabetes and obesity. If that really is true, that's diet. You know, the diabetes epidemic and the obesity epidemic, yeah, it has a lot to do with the sedentary lifestyles that we have, but it's calorie overload. The very principles that you hear hanging around all the plant-based physicians, the fat you eat is the fat you wear, the one I added to it after a few key publications in 2016, the sugar you eat is the fat you wear. So we've got to do something about it. We have to continue preaching about it until people realize that they can control their own destiny, how long they live, and the enjoyment of their life is really dependent on their lifestyle and their habits.
So I read the piece you published in MedPage Today on Cardio Buzz, which I guess was you published just before you became the president of the American College of Cardiology. And the thing that really hit me was you talked to this patient about her improvement on the Ornish plan, and you took it seriously. And I have so many stories of clients of mine and just, you know, casual conversation about someone who adopted a plant-based diet, got better, reversed everything, and their doctor basically said, oh, wow, that's great. And the patient sort of was waiting for the doctor to say, what did you do? What can I learn from this? The doctor never said it. So the patient would then say, so do you want to know how I did it? And the doctor would say, nah, not really. Like, what was it just that you yourself were worried about your cholesterol? What do you think made you different, take a different path and really take an interest and say, wow, there's something here that I have to learn from?
Well, part of it is that my interest in nuclear cardiology and every detail of that, you know, there was a great conversation with the lady because we were really good data collectors. I have a reporting system that's unique, and it has every detail that you could ever want. And, you know, to see a scan dramatically improve like that, which I had seen before after multi-vessel angioplasty or four-vessel bypass surgery, I'd seen improvements, but there was no such claim that any procedure had been done to this patient. So I had to call her, find out what happened. And, you know, it really was diet and exercise. So, yeah, that was going to stick in my brain because those pictures are, just, you know, they're still in my brain right now. It's hard to imagine someone dramatically improving so much. And so yes, I think the fact that I was a nuclear cardiologist and could actually see what was happening to blood flow in the heart was actually very helpful and critical. And, in fact, Dean Ornish had published this. This was not unique. He actually published it not with the rudimentary usual kind of cameras that we use in nuclear, but the fancy ones, the PET scanners, the ones that are really expensive. And he published, they're very accurate. There's no question about the changes that you can actually quantify, really carefully measure the percent change in blood flow. He actually has shown it. That, you know, he can show it in as little as 3 months, dramatic improvement. Before you have much chance for the arteries to open up. So why does it work? Probably because those small, you know, the lining of the arteries, the so-called endothelial cells, they are a live, active organism that Dr. Esselstyn always talks about. You're just trashing them with oils. You go on an Ornish diet or an Esselstyn diet, and you're going to improve the function of those little linings of your blood vessels, and they're going to carry more flow. And so it really, it was all circulating in my head when I found out that I had a high cholesterol, and yeah, changing the diet could fix that as well.
Gotcha. So just for people who don't know what a nuclear cardiologist is, possibly including myself, can you explain?
Sure. So yeah, two words that don't go together, nuclear and medicine, right? So nuclear medicine really came about after World War II, after the bomb. If you have decay of uranium or polonium, you know, in any kind of nuclear reactor, you get a lot of junk. And one of those pieces of junk was a compound called technetium. Another one that you can make is called thallium. Things that have relatively low amount of radiation burden if you inject them into a patient, and they have specific properties. So thallium was the first one that became very famous because thallium scanning could detect whether or not there was a problem with blood flow. You inject it in a vein, the coronary arteries will bring it to your heart or not based on how good the blood flow is. And the heart takes it up. Heart thinks that it's potassium, so it's supposed to be in high concentration in every cell. That I just described with thallium in the heart is reproduced for a variety of nuclear tracers and nuclear compounds all over the body. So there's thyroid scans. Brain scans sort of went away when CAT scans came out. Bone scans are still done very heavily. There are scans for infection and scans for cancer. And so nuclear medicine actually is mostly about diagnosis. There is a small portion of it still where you do nuclear medicine treatment to try and improve someone's like bone pain, for example, look at try to improve their thyroid when it's overactive by giving them radioactive iodine. But most of what you do in nuclear medicine is diagnosis. And nuclear cardiology got to be the very largest part of nuclear medicine. It still is. Probably over 50% of them are heart studies, just because it became a really good way of telling what a patient's risk is. Almost everybody in the United States who eats animals has some degree of coronary artery disease. And having a couple of tiny plaques with perfectly normal flow, you've got a good outcome. If your flow is limited a little, not so good outcome. And you can actually do sort of a stair step or increasing risk with increasing abnormality when you look at a scan of the heart done with stress and compared to a resting one. So that's basically it in a nutshell. We try to tell, you tell people who is it that needs an angiogram, who is it that needs bypass surgery. You can tell that by doing a nuclear stress test.
Gotcha. And you're looking at the heart itself as opposed to Dr. Esselstyn's pictures of the coronary arteries. Is that a different type of diagnosis that he wrote about in Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease?
Yep, very different. And Dean Ornish wrote about both angiograms and nuclear so-called PET scans. So the one that we're doing is not invasive. The one that Dr. Esselstyn's talking about, you actually have to go in through the artery, into the artery from an artery that's attached to it, run a tube up there, shoot dye, that sort of thing. We actually can do a pretty good job of simulating that nowadays with a CAT scanner. If you do the images appropriately, you can get very nice angiograms of the heart non-invasively. But to make it sort of simple, the angiogram is a roadmap. It's an anatomic roadmap, 40% narrowing here, 80% narrowing there. But the nuclear tells you what the flow is like. Well, how good is that 40% functioning? Because sometimes there's a 40% that is blocking the flow, and sometimes there's an 80% narrowing with normal flow. And you need to treat the ones that have the abnormalities, not the ones that just look like they're bad.
Gotcha. So there's a meme that I see on my Facebook feed at least twice a week. It's got your picture and a quote, right, that says there are two kinds of cardiologists, vegans and those who haven't read the data.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when you published your piece, you got a lot of pushback from people who have read some data. And it seems like over the last 5 years, there's really been a pushback against the idea that cholesterol has anything to do with heart disease, with health, that, the bacon diets and high fat diets are the way to go, or high protein, low carb diets are the best thing. And I know lots of people who are on them and who appear to be losing weight. What's your assessment of where the evidence is in terms of, like, what can we say for sure? What have you seen in the last few years that is the most convincing? Because it's so confusing for lots of people.
So let me deal with that second, Howard. The first thing I want to do, I kind of wish people would stop sending that around. I said it, and I actually said the words, "I like to joke that," and they took that off. Okay.
Oh. Oops.
But if you say something out loud, sometimes you have to own it. And so what's happened over the years is that I've had a number of cardiologists initially, look at that and say, how could he say something so, trash all of his colleagues? But I've also had people who are in cardiology read the data and become vegan. And so I'm kind of glad I said it, and I do want to explain to you what I meant by that, but I have to admit that I really don't want to stop what I'm doing until the leading cause of death in cardiologists is no longer heart disease.
Huh. So you said that very specifically. It almost slipped by me, that cardiologists themselves die of heart disease, cardiovascular disease, more than any other cause.
Absolutely. They're Americans on an American diet, most of them. And so I want to save the lives. I'm tired of my colleagues dying. One happened this about 6 weeks ago in Indianapolis. I won't say his name without talking about his with his family for permission. But, we get a report that he drove off the highway, off the road, across the strip, and landed into a house, and turns out he had sudden cardiac death. And when are we going to stop? We manage the disease so well and everyone else, but then we succumb to it. And so anyway, back to the quote, what I was really talking about when I was joking about that, I was talking about the fact that we keep publishing, we at Switching Hats now to the vegan community, keep publishing studies in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Why not in the Journal of American College of Cardiology? Why not American Journal of Cardiology, where you have a vegan editor? Why not make sure that all of the data is getting in front of the cardiologists? So that the dig was against the researchers, not against the cardiologists, interestingly enough. Now, the fact of the matter is, since I said that, we have had some inroads. I did become president of ACC. We do have some ability to affect how the college gets things done. We were able to set up a nutrition subcommittee of the prevention council, and that nutrition subcommittee has Andy Freeman, who's an amazing vegan cardiologist, and a wide variety of folks, Dean Ornish, Caldwell Esselstyn, wonderful, wonderful people who all have different points of view. We have Mediterranean people, we have, Mediterranean diet people. We have a paleo person, we have, you know, a variety of folks with a variety of points of views. But ultimately, we can get together and write a review article that goes into JACC, where the cardiologists will come out of that. If they read it, they're going to come out of it with more information about nutrition probably than they got in their entire career, because it's so minimal for most of us. And so the pitch really is about education and research and doing it within cardiology where it's going to have the most impact. Yeah. So anyway.
So go ahead. You had more to say on the whole
question. Oh, no, I just wanted to go back to your second point is, you know, where are we? How much have we done? How do we deal with the Time magazine saying that butter is in and all of these issues? Well, the issue really is that we have to be very careful of separating science from pseudoscience. And I'm saying a very strong word again. And the pseudoscience is, a problem when there are conflicts of interest and particularly relationships with industry that influence the outcome. Where do I even start? I just give you two quick stories. Number one was we woke up to, back in I think February of 2015, to the recommendations from the dietary advisory group that were supposed to make the recommendations for a report that then becomes the dietary guidelines for the United States for the next 5 years. And it said some fantastic things. I mean, I learned so much. Oh, did you know coffee isn't bad for you? Huge study. 4 cups of coffee lowers diabetes and stroke. Okay, I'll try to do coffee. I hate the stuff. I'll try it anyway. Whatever, you know, if there's really a good scientific basis behind it. They said that people should eliminate or minimize red meat. They said that sugar was a problem. They said that Americans eat too much protein. This was going on in such a positive way. And then there was a little bit of a problem. They said, oh, and by the way, the previous five-year guidelines said that we should limit cholesterol to 300 milligrams per day. We are now removing the 300 milligram limit because the American College of Cardiology says that cholesterol is no longer a nutrient of concern for consumption. And I'm saying, wait a minute, I read our guidelines, I approved our guidelines, because the vice president is on the board of trustees. I don't remember this statement at all. So they referenced us incorrectly, and they referenced an analysis, a compilation of studies that looked at eggs and said that eggs were perfectly safe if you compared all of the data of 0 to 1 per week versus 7 or more per week, that those two groups have the same cardiovascular outcome. Well, I had to see that. So I pulled that article, and believe it or not, that's not what it said either. It actually said that, yeah, no difference in cardiovascular outcome, but if you, over the short term, but you increase your rate of diabetes by 42% short term And if you, and short by the way, in 5 to 16 years, most of the physicians would hope that their patients would live more than 5 to 16 years. And if you were diabetic, it increased your cardiovascular mortality rate by 69%. That is not a negative study. You don't use that as a basis for saying don't worry about how much cholesterol or how many eggs you're eating. So we galvanized our nutrition committee to start writing editorials about it. We published a couple from Rush University. We really went on all fronts, all available mechanisms to try to influence this. We had already developed, because of our population health foray at the American College of Cardiology, we had relationships with the White House and USDA, Health and Human Services. We rang all their phone numbers. We got meetings together. It took a little research to find out that there were members of that writing group who were paid by the Egg Board. And that's an unfortunate kind of reality. And that reality came through very loud and clear. There was a lot of lobbying about that document. A lot of those wonderful things that were in the initial document about, you know, not eating red meat and that sort of stuff got changed. They ended up watering down a bit the recommendations about foods, and they kind of stuck to the nutrients. Well, people don't eat nutrients, they eat foods. And so it became more of a problematic document. However, we did win after showing them the Institute of Medicine report from 2001, and they actually quoted it saying people should eat as little cholesterol as possible. So they are removing the 300 milligram limit, but for a completely opposite reason than they were saying before. It's because you shouldn't eat any. And if anybody knows their nutrition at all, they know that there are only three animal products that don't have cholesterol. That would be like egg whites, Jell-O, and honey. And so that essentially means that people are going to be a vegetarian and preferably vegan in order to avoid eating cholesterol. So anyway, we kind of won, but we didn't necessarily win because the first one about eliminating any concern about eating cholesterol hit the news, and there was no big retraction, even though we got that changed completely. The other example that I would mention, because I think it's so important, was sort of the beginning of all of this. So we got to see what the red meat folks could do and what the Egg Board could do to influence a document and influence public policy. But little did we know that this started really, really about five decades ago. And so this got published in the Journal of American Medical Association last summer. It was an unfortunate discovery at an Ivy League university that the Department of Nutrition chair had systematically gone on a campaign to remove sugar at the behest of the and payments that were recorded from the newly found Sugar Research Foundation to point the cardiovascular disease cause away from sugar and towards saturated fat. And so we all grew up, even as vegans, thinking, avoid saturated fat. If you're going to get it from animals, you shouldn't do that. But sugar's okay. It's a plant. Well, it turns out if you look at it very carefully, I actually had seen, before this came out, I had seen a couple of publications, one in Journal of American Medical Association and one actually in American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, talking about outcomes and sugar intake and the outcomes being bad. But no one knew that there had been five decades of suppression of this kind of information and sort of twisting where the research would go and what would get published and the like. So we do have a problem with what you're asking. Where is the data? Where are we? We are in basically sort of, dare I say, a food fight. You know, I mean, this really is it's a major issue. Because what we're asking people to do goes against a lot of strong industries. And everyone says things like, if you were to eliminate all animal products, that our greenhouse gas problems would go away, that we could solve world hunger by feeding U.S. grain to all the needy countries. Well, it also would eliminate a lot of jobs, and it also would upset a lot of people whose lifestyle has been that way. So I don't know that I have one of those global answers. It would be great if everyone in the planet would eat like me, and we could take all of our cardiologists and turn them into, you know, infectious disease people or something like that, because that's what would happen if everybody was a vegan. We would have very little need in this country for cardiology. But I can't answer the global questions, but we could try to address them, and we can certainly address them as individuals. And wouldn't it be nice if we could do it before they develop the heart attack and the stroke, instead of getting them motivated after the fact?
Right. And I remember reading about some of that sugar stuff, and it felt like I was going to have to be disloyal to my team to kind of acknowledge this and write about it. You know, I think this was like Mark Hegstead, right?
If you do I don't recall the lady's name. I could Google it really quick. But it's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I think it came out in October or so. It should be pretty easy to find because I keep all that stuff pretty close to, I have it on slides, but it's easier to find it, I think.
Right. Well, I'm looking here at a JAMA Network sugar industry.
Sugar? Yep.
Yeah.
Sugar. So this is September. I did it. I've got it as September 12th. So Kristen Kearns, that's the name I was looking for. Kristen Kearns. And there was an accompanying editorial specifically about what I've just mentioned, that is Food Industry Funding of Nutrition Research. Marion
right.
Neffel wrote that. And I've used
right,
that graphic now. Go ahead.
But, you know, so when I first heard about this, so, you know, I read about it in the New York Times, so there was, you know, the Mark Hegstead became the head of nutrition at the USDA, and, you know, he's quoted twice or mentioned twice in the China study.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's mentioned in Whole, the book that I worked on with Colin Campbell. And like, you know, it felt like I had this urge to suppress this, like, you know, no sugar, like it was set up, like either sugar or saturated fat had to be the enemy. And it's very refreshing to hear you say, you know, sugar is also bad, because it was like, you know, well, it's either Esselstyn or Lustig. It's either, you know, Taubes or Campbell. Like we have to choose sides, and we're no longer allowed to look at evidence, even evidence that maybe contradicts what our team thinks. You know what I'm saying?
In the clinic, Sarah Wendland.
Right. So yes, indeed. Well, I'm glad that you've at least. That you're bringing attention to this. It's really an important issue, and I think it's something that we're all going to have to deal with. And one of these days, we are going to have a good dissociation between nutrition research and nutrition and the relevant industries. Yeah, but it's not going to be easy to get there. So that was just my administrative assistant letting me know that I'm supposed to be in another place at 3 p.m. and that I'm late.
Okay. Okay, well, we better let you get there.
So I'm sorry. It's been a great time talking to you, and hopefully people will be able to keep looking for more and more research, hopefully more in cardiology publications, and hopefully free of the shackles of industry.
Right on. Well, thank you for your work. Thank you for your time. Get to your next appointment. We'll connect via email for a closing, but I really appreciate all you're doing, and you're an inspiration on so many levels. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. All righty. Take care now.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. More than anything else, those reviews help us reach more listeners and spread the message. And for more information about the Big Change Program led by me and Josh Lajani, visit bigchangeprogram.com. And be sure to check out the show notes for today's episode with links to everything we talked about at plantyourself.com/218. If you're new to the show, you can catch up on 217 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. And if you get the podcast, but not my weekly-ish Big Change Bulldog newsletter, you can sign up and also this week get the Stop Self-Sabotage Report at plantyourself.com/sabotage. Okay, here we go. Thanks to Plant Yourself podcast patrons Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Marrow, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Alan Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jenna Filanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious, Michelle X, Elizabeth Feldman, Victoria Dolomanova, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Andrew, Josina, Julianne Rowland, Stu Dolnick, Sarah Durkis, Randall Circus, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Pedersen, Leanne Peterson, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, G. Gila, Lissert, David Donahoe, Blair Seibert, Doreen Avodzov. Okay, Doron. You beat me. Doron Avizov rhymes with Keep the Cheese Off. Gio and Carolyn Argentati. Jody Friesner. Ruth Ann Funderburk. Misha Rosen. Michael Warabek. The equally mysterious Tracy Z. Alicia Lemus. Rebecca Hughes. Val Linneman rhymes with Cinnamon. Nick Harper. David Donahue. Stephanie Holmes. Martha Bergner. Oh, another breath with only four to go, but I'll do these carefully. They're all new. Nicole Ramsey. Susan Ahmad. Molly Levine. And the inscrutable Harry R. For all of your generous support of the podcast. And thanks also to musician extraordinaire Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song Sabali Don, Dance of Peace. If you haven't yet, check out Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. That's R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R with a will in the front, .com. If you'd like to support the show and help get the message out there, you can share this and other episodes on social media. You can email it to your friends. You can write that iTunes review, and you can become a patron of the show with a one-time gift, or really, I'm looking for ongoing contributions, even if it's just a dollar a month at Patreon, and you can do it at patreon.com/plantyourself or plantyourself.com and just look for the Patreon link in the right sidebar. In garden news, I'm trying to get as many calories as possible from the garden over the next few weeks. We've got cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, basil, green beans, and whatever squash we can rescue from the stem borers. Although it does seem that our main crop these days is Japanese beetles and stem borers and various caterpillars. We are looking for non-toxic ways of keeping enough of our harvest to make it worth our time and effort, but we're definitely elbowing other critters in an attempt to gather some of our own bounty. In running news, boy, am I sluggish and slow these days. And some of my Strava runs, if you follow me on Strava, they're kind of a bit embarrassing when you look not so much at the distance, but at the pace. I'm not sure if it's the heat or the humidity or whether I'm overtrained or undertrained or whatever, but I'm just playing at the edge, listening to my body, and generally erring on the side of too much rather than too little, and we'll see if that's a smart error or not. That's it for this week. As always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize, all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.